Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Last night, I think we'd all agree that going into last night, this had not been the most amazing World Series. Hell, I think we'd all agree the first five games were not that good at all. But game six was unbelievable. Hell of a game, an insane ride, and a game that broke into two separate parts. There was what happened before the incident, and then there was what happened after the incident. And if you don't know what the incident was, I'm not sure what game you were watching. Washington went into last night's game having lost three straight at home. And it wasn't just that they lost three straight, it's how they lost. They got hammered over the weekend. They went from being up 2-0 to down 3-2, and they scored a total of three runs in those three games. Seemed like they had lost their mojo completely. And then they had to come back and deal with Justin Verlander in Houston and a crowd that was insane, knowing they needed just one win to finish. Nats needed that win to stay alive. But the thing about the Nats, as badly as they played, even with their backs to the wall, you know they'd have it no other way. They live for that. They love that. To be the man, you have to beat the man, and they probably love the fact that they were going to have to beat arguably the best American League pitcher of a generation, and they were going to have to do it on the road to stay alive. But again, I'm going to say they love that. They love it because, as I tweeted last night, these are some BMFs, and they came out firing. Their leadoff hitter, Trey Turner. And if you didn't know about this guy before, he is the ultimate gamer. This guy is so tough. He gets on base. Adam Eaton moves him over, and then Anthony Rendon comes up.
He'll hit with the knees bent, almost out of a crouch, the bat chest high, the pitch. Swinging a ground ball through the open right side and into right center field, a base hit. Rounding third is Trey Turner. He comes in to score. And the Nationals accomplished what they were after at the start of this game with their game plan. Score early, get on the board.
Nats Radio, 1-0 Nats. Remember those names, Turner, Eaton, Rendon, because they're going to get mentioned a time or two again. But then the Astros come right back. Their bats woke up in the district. They started playing Astros baseball again, and that continued in the bottom of the first. George Springer leads off with a double. He goes to third on a wild pitch, and Jose Altuve brings him home with a sac fly. Michael Brantley strikes out. Then comes Alex Bregman.
Pitch on the way. And that is drilled deep to left field. And you can kiss it goodbye. Into the Landry's Crawford boxes. Alex Bregman goes yard. And the Astros go up 2-1.
My man, Alex Bregman. That's Astros Radio. 2-1 Astros. But the most important part of that home run was not the home run or the run that went on the board. It was the run around the bases and the fact that Alex Bregman achieved godlike status by carrying the bat with him down to first base and trying to hand it to the first base coach. That is incredible. Bat flips are so regular season, but the bat carry is now. And the bat carry is awesome. Bat flips are tired. The bat carry is wired. And yes, I know the red asses who police the game are not going to like that. I just don't give a crap. You're playing at home. Game six of the World Series. You just went yard. I don't care if this guy runs back to the on-deck circle and grabs a second bat for the journey. I don't care if this guy went Barry Bonds, pirouette in the box, flapped down a la Jeffrey Leonard, and then skipped around the bases backwards and took 5 minutes to do it. The only problem that I had with the bat carry was that Alex Bregman apologized for it.
It's not how I was raised to play the game. I just let my emotions get the best of me, and I'm sorry for doing that.
Alex, sorry. Apology not accepted. I'm not hearing it. I'm not having it. Because you have nothing to apologize for, hero. Because that was awesome. Carrying a bat down to first base is not ruining the game. It's improving the game. He didn't disrespect the game. He fixed the game. And if you don't believe me, ask one of the guys that he allegedly was showing up. National stud, Juan Soto. He saw it and he loved it. Quote, "It's pretty cool. I want to do it too. That's what I think when I saw that. I get the opportunity and I do the same thing, end quote. And he did. So if the most electric guy in the other dugout was not offended by it, why should anyone else be? The answer is you shouldn't. So the Astros have the lead. That house was rocking. And if Houston were playing any other team, you might have been able to start to count down the outs until the champagne. But again, the Nats are not any other team. We know this. And in the fifth, Adam Eaton did this.
Now Verlander winds and delivers. Eaton swings and hits one to deep right. Down the line. Going. Going. Gone. Goodbye. A game-tying solo home run for Adam Eaton on an 0-1 pitch from Justin Verlander.
And then he gets back to the dugout. He finds his guy, Howie Kendrick, and he does this. It's like the best baseball celebration. Rev the engine, shift the gears. Oh, and speaking of high speed, one out later, a ball left the yard at light speed.
Lander straight up as he takes signs, now into his wide. Here's the pitch. Soto swings and hits one high and deep to right. This is way back. Going, going, and gone. Goodbye. Into the second deck. A tremendous home run for Juan Soto.
Juan Jose Soto, the inventor of the Soto shuffle. Man, that was not a home run either. That was just a joke. A complete and utter joke. A complete and utter joke that a guy that young is crushing baseballs like that. And yes, the only thing better than the home run was the fact that he did carry his bat down to first base. So for all you haters, red assers, take a seat, meat. I've got no time for people complaining about that. Besides, it's not like Bregman and Soto just invented that last night. Bartolo Colon was doing that years ago. He's the real OG of the bat carry. So, 3-2 Nats in the fifth. But the Astros came right back in the bottom of the inning. Runners in second and third. One out. But Steven Strasburg gets Altuve to strike out and Brantley to ground out. And notice, that's the first time I've mentioned Strasburg's name. But it won't be the last. But as much as you want to think the last night was about Strasburg or Verlander or Bregman or Soto, you're wrong. Because here comes Samuel Woodford Holbrook, and he's about to yank the entire spotlight for himself. Because the only thing worse than knowing an umpire's name is knowing an umpire's government. And if I'm doing that, you know there's a damn good reason. A damn good chance that someone in blue made a potential World Series changing mistake. Top of the seventh, runner on first, Brad Peacock pitching for Houston, Trey Turner at the plate. Roll it. Man, roll the hell out of this.
First pitch to Turner. And a full swing and a dribbler up the third base side. This is going to be a tough chance. Peacock hurries his throw, and the ball gets away. The ball through Gurriel down the right field line. Gomes is going to head for third and Turner to second as Gurriel's glove got knocked off, and they're going to call Turner out for being out of the baseline.
Oh, my.
So instead of second and third, they're going to send Gomes back to first, and Turner is out for being out of the baseline. And Davey Martinez is livid at Sam Holbrook.
Turner sprints down the line. He gets to first as the ball is coming in. It gets away from Gurriel at first. He goes to second. Yan Gomes goes to third. Suddenly, the Nats are cooking. Runners on second and third. Nobody out. Except that's not what happened because the home plate umpire, Sam Holbrook, called Turner out for runner interference. He went rule 509A11 on everybody. Turner is out. Gomes goes back to first. Hell yes. That's awesome. How very umpire of them. I know you were enjoying this game between the two teams, but what about us? What about the umps? Are you paying and watching to see players play? Or are you there to see the umps ump? Am I right? So, it was time for the umps to take over, and they did. And Nationals manager Dave Martinez was raging, and so were a number of baseball players on Twitter. Quickly. On Twitter, Jake Arrieta, quote, "That is an absolutely awful call. What are we doing?" Travis Shaw on Twitter, "Dumbest rule in Major League Baseball. Absolutely no reason for that to be called ever." Delino DeShields on Twitter, "You can't make that call in the World Series. The ball took the first baseman off the base." Gaucho Michael Young on Twitter, "That is a complete and total embarrassment." Gaucho's right. It was a complete and total embarrassment. But if there's one thing you can bet on, it's the fact that the umpires will make complete and total embarrassments of themselves. It's their brand.
Improve visibility and save money at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Stop by for their See Better, Drive Safer sale, where you can earn a $15 gift card after mail-in rebate when you purchase either Sylvania headlight bulbs or Bosch Focus or Treco Titan wiper blades. They'll even install your wiper blades for free while you wait. Do not risk your safety because of poor visibility. Let the professional parts people at O'Reilly help you find just what you need. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Gerard Gallant is my guest. Gerard, great to have you back. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Good, good. So you're coming off a win over Anaheim where you got a really big performance from the line of Nicholas Roy, Ryan Reeves, William Carrier. Let me jump right into that. You and I have talked about Reeves in the past and what he means in terms of physicality. But when you're getting scoring from that line, how special is that?
Yeah, that helps our team a lot. I mean, they're a really good forechecking line, and they're an aggressive line, and they tend to make contact and make the game easier for other players. But when they're putting the puck at the net, and, you know, like I said, Reeves scored in that game, Wash scored in that game, Carrier had some great chances. So that they're a big part of our team, but when they can score goals, they definitely help us win.
Now, on top of that, you said your guys were kind of pissed off after that Colorado game. When they showed up the way they did against Anaheim, did it feel more like the style and the game that you're used to playing?
Well, exactly. I mean, we got a real good hockey team and a skilled hockey team, but we had to bring our game level up, and I thought that was by far our best game of the season, and we just got to continue to do that. I mean, it was a simple game. It was a hard-working game. It was doing the dirty things in the corner and winning those battles, and that's what you do to win hockey games. And it's like the teams are so close together now, and the parity in the league is unbelievable. So when you compete and play hard, you get a good chance to win every night.
Gerard Gallant is joining us. You know, you mentioned how skilled your team is. Bruins head coach Bruce Cassidy was also talking about how heavy your team is. Now, I know speed is important to you. You want to play fast. But how important is it to have that heaviness? And then you want to make sure your opponents know your guys are going to hit. So how do you balance those two things?
Yeah, no, and that's a big part of it. Like you said, I think we got some big, strong guys through our lineup. We're a heavy team, definitely in the back end. We got some big, heavy guys, and I think it's an important part of the game. We don't play a mean game or a very physical game. We play a tough game that, you know, you win the battles in front of the net, you win the puck battles, and that makes you play fast. I mean, we don't go out there and try and finish every check we do. Ryan Reeves and that line, they got a role to play, and they play it real well. But our top players, you know, they want to win battles. They want to go hard to the net, and but they want to play a fast game. And you can't play a real fast game when you're trying to finish checks or getting checks all the time. So our guys know their roles in their team and what they do and what works best for our group. And that's a fine line. Like you said, you want to play physical, but you also want to play fast.
Gerard Gallant joining us once again. Now, you've gotten off to a really nice start, and you're doing this mostly without defenseman Nate Schmidt, who is expected to return shortly. How much does he change things, both defensively and with his ability to transition from defense to offense and jump into the play?
Yeah, Nate's a big, big part of our group, obviously. And, you know, give credit to the other guys. We missed Nate from, I think he played one period for us this season so far, so we missed him for quite a bit. But, you know, he just makes the game so much easier. He puts people in the position they're supposed to be in. Now he'll move up with their top pair and play against the other team's best lines, and he moves the puck real well. He's a great skater, so he does everything for us, and he just makes our team that much better. So, you know, it might be tough on him his first couple of games once he gets back, and hopefully he'll have a good practice today, and we're hoping he gets clear for tomorrow, but we'll have to wait and see.
We're talking some hockey. Gerard Gallant, my guest. Back in February, the team made that move for Mark Stone. You had him down the stretch last season. He made an immediate impact, but now that you've had even more time with him and the entire offseason with him, how unique is he?
He's unbelievable. He's a great player. He does everything right for us. He's a good team leader. Everything I heard about him is exactly what, you know, is exactly what he does every day for our group. It's not just, you know, playing the games and being a top player in the league. He's a great person. He comes to the rink. He wants to get better every day. He makes his teammates better. He's a fun-loving guy. So, you know what? It's an unbelievable player for us to get. And like I said, he makes our team so much better.
Right, so if we're talking about special guys, a guy that you and I have talked about also in the past, Marc-Andre Fleury, 8-3, 2.3 goals against, you know, status quo for this guy. But what has he meant to you and to this organization from day one?
Well, we wouldn't be 8-5 right now this year, I'll tell you, because we haven't played our best hockey, and you know, our record's pretty good considering, and Marc-Andre Fleury's been outstanding this year. But for the whole package, I mean, the day we got him in expansion draft, you hear nothing but great things about the guy. He comes to the rink. He's our leader. He's our character guy, and he just loves to have fun. He keeps our group loose, real loose, and he gets them ready to play games. And like I said, I see why he won 3 Stanley Cups, and he's such a good goaltender, but he's a better person than he is a goaltender. He just he comes to the rink every day, and it's not a job. It's what he wants to do.
So we're talking Golden Knights hockey. From an organizational standpoint, you and I have also talked in the past. It seems like every time you and I talk, I come away with this notion or this feeling that you and this team are a perfect fit in the sense that the style of play and personality of the players are so similar to yours. So in the salary cap era, managing a roster is a constant challenge. You can't always keep all the guys that you want. But how much have you and George McPhee focused on defining what it means to be a Golden Knight and how you want your guys to play?
Yeah, and that started from the first day I was hired with George and Kelly. You know, we talked about it all the time. We want leadership. We want character. We want good people in our organization. And, you know, that was the first thing about the expansion draft. We wanted to get good people. And, you know, there's not many bad people in the NHL, but we wanted that was a priority for us, character. But I think the style of our group, we started from day one. We wanted to play hard. We wanted to play fast. We wanted to be a big, heavy team, and we don't want to get pushed around. And so we got the team that we think can do that. And like I said, the first year went unbelievable well. Nobody expected that, including myself. And from that point on, I think there's a, you know, our ownership's been unbelievable to our players, and he supports everybody at our organization. And from the top down bottom, it's been fun. It's been great. And, you know, we just want to keep it rolling. And it's been a fun 2.5 years. And like I said, the biggest thing is let's just keep it going. Let's look one day at a time and get ready for your next opponent.
So what about those 2.5 years? Now, to your point, that first year was absolutely amazing. I mean, unprecedented for a season, the kind of season that probably was beyond just about anybody's wildest expectations. You follow that up with another strong season, but one that ended a little bit earlier in the playoffs. So what was that experience like? Was it more painful than getting so close, or essentially is any loss painful no matter when it happens?
You know what? Getting to the finals and losing was as much pain as I ever had in my life in professional sports. You know, that was real tough because you're so close and you're right there. And, you know, Washington was a great team, but it wasn't a team that we couldn't have beaten. You know, we would have played our best hockey. And, you know, you got to give them credit. They played incredible hockey that year, and they won it, and they deserved to win it. But and last year was a different experience. It was tough. It was the first round. We're battling with a real good San Jose team. And, you know, it was going back and forth. And to lose like that, it was real tough on our group. But you know what? Losing makes you tougher and makes you better. And hopefully we'll rebound this year and we'll be hungry again. And then, you know, get an opportunity to make the playoffs. And that's what the goal is right now.
Gerard Gallant, my guest. One final thought. I know you're not going to make it about you. You never want to. But earlier this year, you did coach your 500th career NHL game. For somebody who started out coaching with the Summerside Capitals of the Maritime Junior Hockey League, what does it mean to pass 500 games as an NHL head coach?
Well, I've been real fortunate. I've been real lucky in my life, you know, to play 600 games in the NHL as a player and to be able to be assistant coach and be a head coach. It's a dream come true because hockey's been my life from the time I was 16 years old. So it's been fortunate. If you can't play the game, I think coaching's the next best. And I come to the rink every day a little bit like Marc-Andre Fleury. I have fun. I enjoy my time here, and it's the best job in the world.
He is a Jack Adams Award winner, led the Golden Knights to a Western Conference title in his first season. They're currently in second in the Pacific. Gerard Gallant, my guest. Gerard, I always appreciate the conversation. Thanks so much. Great to have you back.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it.
Are you craving some protein after a good workout? Don't make a shake. Don't eat a bar. Grab a bag of beef jerky from Old Trapper. Old Trapper beef jerky is tasty and it's tender, and it's made with real strips of steak in quality spices that are smoked over a wood fire, and it goes wherever you go. To the game, to the gym, to the beach, anywhere at all. Look for Old Trapper in the Clearview bag. You can see the quality you're buying. Look for it in major retail stores near you. Clones, if you can't see it, ask for it by name because no other jerky compares. Old Trapper, what's your beef? Let's go to the phones. Let's go to L.A. Let's go to Matt in L.A. Hey, Matt, how are you?
The pimp in the box. What is up, Vance, Matt? Hey, Goosebumps, Evel Knievel, and Game 7. Thanks for the vine. From Wilmington to Washington, D.C. From Duarte to the district, you're welcome. Romy, since the days Quinn the car fixer in Kirwin and Riverside called in regularly, since Ira Craig was Mike Piazza and Eric Karros' ticket benefactor instead of the jungle's resident hobo, your boy Matt in L.A. has had your back. like one David Martinez, manager of the year IMO, has his team's back. Even with some bogus runners interference call and countless Houston home cooking calls throughout this series by this clown car of buffoons that kidnapped the umpires and is masquerading as MLB zebras, the Expos are on Destiny's doorstep once again. Anthony Rendon and a million to Juan Soto are mashing more frequently than potatoes by Belly Clarkson's chef. And Steve freaking Strasburg became Jack Morris seemingly overnight. The Nationals are not only the feel-good story of the postseason, pimp, with their mix of grizzled vets and live arms, and despite gas candle Rodney attempting to arson the series single-handedly, this group from Zim to Eaton to Dr. Doolittle's goggles and Siberian husky eyes Scherzer, DC is showing serious gonad, serious natitude. And since those legislative branch losers can't come in and hype up Davey Martinez in the Expos, Sacre Bleu, pimp, you bet your ass and your Montreal smoked meat sandwich that Matt in L.A. will. Tonight, Houston and Mattress Mac are taking the loss, pimp. Wear it, H-Town. Aloha means a hola. Wear it's Rick Eisenhower asking the boys of the XR4TI if they know of a good cobbler. Wear James Kelly's hard hat, cranium case, and twine rope arms. And wear Sir Ira Craigington, Ira's great-grandfather and now patron saint of the hobos. Outro!
Outro, Matt! What's not to respect about that guy? What's not to love about that guy? Has that guy ever sounded better than he did right there? Man, the straight fire, the heat, the passion, the ability to turn a phrase, the ability to crack a skull. Has it ever been better? Have you ever respected it more than that? Wow. Who the hell is going to follow that call? How would you like to be the guy to follow that call? That can't be easy, but somebody's going to do it. Look at dudes hanging up right now knowing that I could go to them. I'm looking at that call bank. They were all just blinking. It was lit up like a Christmas tree. Now there's nothing. It was lit up like my old dashboard on the XR4TI Mirror. Now it's not. But one. One remaining light blinking. Who could it be? Holy crap. It's the BIC. The reigning champ, the best there ever was, Brad in Corona, right after Matt. Bradley, what's up?
Jimbo, how you doing, man?
Good, Brad. How are you? Great to hear you.
I'm fantastic. Thank you. Yeah. Hey, what an honor to follow Matt in L.A. Aloha, Matt. You are an a-hola, okay? I love how Matt starts every phone call by listing off all the places he's never been to and can't afford to go. Wilmington to Washington, D.C. to anywhere more than a $10 Uber ride away from Gardena. You're welcome. And Matt, stop making jokes about Belly Clarkson, dude. You're fatter than Belly Clarkson. It doesn't make sense. You can't make fun of someone for being fat when you're fatter and uglier than they are. That's not how this works, dude. Matthew is a troubled young man, Jim. I don't know if you've ever checked out his Twitter feed, but his posts are borderline insane. He's like an even dumber version of Ray Lewis, if that makes any sense. He wakes up every morning and posts, "Thank you, God. God is amazing," which is fine, but then he chases that with four pictures that are so random they look like one of those tests you have to take on a website to prove you're not a robot. Like, click on all the photos Matt just posted of a crosswalk sign. Okay, now click on the one where it's just a dirt hill behind Matt's house. Okay, now the beach. Matt, we appreciate you, dude, but respectfully, and this was actually from his feed yesterday, Jim, we don't need to see pictures of a peacock next to a beware of dog sign. Stop taking drugs, dude, or you're going to see God sooner than you want to. Jim, just in case anyone forgot, we're entering the home stretch of the Beeks and Caleb weight loss challenge. Of course, Caleb's going to win this thing by default. I don't even know for sure if he lost weight, but we know he didn't gain it. And apparently that's good enough to beat my boy Beeks. I mean, let's face it, Beeks never stood a chance. He collapsed faster than Booger McFarland's forehead, Jim. Beeks is a guy whose stomach starts growling whenever he finds out that the website he's looking at uses cookies. He's very fat, Jim. That's what I'm trying to say there. Anyway, I want to finish with a quick sports take here. Romy, as you know, I'm a huge fan of baseball. I'm fired up about the World Series tonight. And you may or may not know this, but I've always been a major fan of the Houston Astros. Love them, Jim. My favorite player? Glad you asked. It's Houston right fielder. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but Josh Reddick? That is...
That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Bradford? You know, I was going to say the best there is, the best there ever was, but I think I'll just say the best there is, the best there ever was. And he went kamikaze again, but not before he was able to make his points. Brad in Corona. I love the champ showing up the way he does. You never know when he's going to show up. You never know why he's going to show up. I love that he shows up out of season. I mean, you know he's going to show up once a year no matter what to collect that paycheck. But how many classic lines did he have in that call? 1-800-636-8686. It's so funny what he mentioned about how Matt has a bunch of random pictures where you have to click on the ones to get through. The crosswalks. Right before he called, I was clicking on crosswalks. I was doing just that. Not on Matt's feed, but on something else. B.I.C., Brad in Corona. Probably just broke Twitter again. Not going well for Matt again. Man, you don't want to get on the wrong side of Brad. You just don't. You just don't. We are joined now by Derek Lewis. Derek, great to have you on. How are you?
Oh, man. Thanks for having me. Always great to be on your show.
Derek, always great to have you on this show. All right, so we're a couple of days from you making your return to Madison Square Garden. You were there last year for UFC 230 against Daniel Cormier. The result did not go the way you would have liked, but how fired up are you to get back to MSG on Saturday?
I'm real anxious to get back in there, man. I haven't been anxious to fight in years, you know, and this is one of the fights that I'm real anxious to get back in there. I'm excited for. I took everything serious, the whole training camp, my diet, the preparation for it, just everything been on point.
We're talking to Derek Lewis. So, Derek, when you talk about the fact that you have not been as eager in years, how much of that has to do with your health? For instance, it's your first fight after having surgery on your knee. So everybody's clear. We're talking about a situation where your meniscus and MCL were torn. Your ACL was barely hanging on, and you'd been dealing with that for a while. The story goes that you first heard a pop back at UFC 184, and that was in 2015. Is that how long it's been, and how were you able to stand, much less fight, with an injury like that? Derek.
Hello?
Yeah, Derek, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Derek. Yeah, so your knee.
Bad connection.
Yeah, yeah. How bad was your knee?
Oh, my knee was pretty bad. You know, it just kept getting worse and worse. Whenever I fought DC, that every time he touched my leg, I just fall down because I couldn't stand on it anymore. And for that training, I was still in the best shape of my life, like going into the DC fight. But my knee was the only factor in that one that kept giving out on me. And whenever I fought Junior, yeah, I couldn't, the whole training camp, I couldn't go forward or go backwards. So I had to stand in one spot, one place, and hit pads like that. I couldn't even do the Stairmaster like I usually do.
Derek Lewis, my guest. You know, Derek, to that point, a lot of fighters in your situation would have turned down fights in order to get that knee taken care of. But even as it got worse, you still did fight Junior Dos Santos. Your coach, Bob Perez, was not a fan of the idea. He was even in favor of you withdrawing. Why was it so important to you to go ahead and fight, even though you were nowhere near 100%?
Yeah, we had got MRI results back before, like 2 weeks before the Junior fight, and the UFC was worried that I was going to pull. I told them I wasn't going to pull because it's like 2 weeks before the fight. And And so they renegotiated my contract. And so that's one of the big reasons why I took the fight with Junior.
So now you finally are healthy. You've done all this on a busted up knee. How much more effective do you expect to be this weekend as a fighter now that you are healthy?
I feel a completely different type of fighter because I can move around now and I could train a lot harder and a lot more than what I have been in the past. So, you know, everyone should see a better performance, a better fighter out of myself too. This Saturday.
Derek Lewis fighting this Saturday. All right, so you're going to fight Blagoy Ivanov. When you look at him and you prepare for him, what kind of a fighter do you see?
I think he's more of a fighter like myself. Whenever I look at him, because he doesn't set anything up. He's just going there and trying to look for big punches. But the only thing about him that he gets hits a lot. You know, I don't get hit that much that often, you know. But he gets hit a whole lot, and I don't believe that he could take a punch from me the way he fights.
Derek Lewis joining us. So he can't take your best shot. Do you feel like, has he ever been in the cage with a fighter like you and the kind of problems that you can cause for him?
No, I don't believe so. You know, I know for sure that I'm a unique type of fighter because I still have that same killer instinct in the last 10 seconds of a fight. It doesn't matter how tired I am, I can still throw hard just like it was the first round of the fight. So you got to always be cautious with anything I throw.
Derek Lewis fighting this weekend at Madison Square Garden. Now, Derek, you become a huge star, and not just because of your fighting ability, but because of your personality. I'm curious, what's it been like to blow up that quickly? And to blow up like that in a short period of time, does it feel kind of strange to you? Or does it feel like, no, I've been working, grinding for a long time. I'm not an overnight sensation. What's it feel like?
Yeah, it's been crazy because I got movie deals and TV show deals and stuff like that. All because, you know, my personality. So it's been real cool that everyone's really starting to take notice of it. Because I've always been the same type of guy, you know, got a crazy sense of humor. And so it's pretty cool, though.
I wonder about this. Like you told Ariel Helwani that Mike Tyson was hitting you up. How do you handle that? Like when Mike Tyson reaches out, do you take that call? Does he need to go through the proper channels and contact your people before he can actually get to you? How'd you handle that one?
Yeah, I totally have to call my manager first. To see whatever he wanted. So he never called my manager. So that's fine, though. He won't go through the proper channel. That's fine.
That's tremendous. So what do you think? What do you think Mike wanted, if you had to guess?
Now, they came out and told me that he just wanted me to be on his podcast, I guess you have.
See, man, you got to go through the right channels. You got to go through the right channels. I went through the right channels. I got you to come on this show. Come on, Mike. Go through the right channels. It's not that hard, right?
Yeah.
Derek, you got some interviews today, but how do you go about approaching the rest of the week before the fight?
Really, my heart rate is, like, super good right now. Right now, my heart rate is at 52. And so just really just keeping it low as possible and just keeping the pace, like, just really walking on treadmills. That's it. Just keeping everything up and running, you know. But I'm ready to go. I'm happy.
So I'm probably like a lot of you. I think that many of us have the same question, namely, where does our family come from? What's our background? You can discover more about your family and learn about your own story by combining the Ancestry DNA test with billions of historical family records. Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. You see, Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started, and they're able to do so by using precise geographical detail and clear-cut historical insights. I mean, it is absolutely crazy what they can uncover. You can even trace your ancestors' journeys over time. You can follow how and why your family moved from place to place, things that you don't even know. And to amplify the results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree. See your ancestors. Become more than just a name. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. And only Ancestry can lay out a story like that with unique features to give a more complete picture about a person. So what you want to do is go to Ancestry.com/Rome right now and take 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com/Rome and take 20% off your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com/Rome. It is a fascinating process. Check it out yourself. He is a lead NHL analyst and horse racing analyst for NBC Sports. He played 16 years in the NHL. He won a Stanley Cup with the New York Rangers. He is a member of the 1984 Olympic team and the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame, a recipient of the Ace Bailey Award for Courage, an NHL ambassador for Hockey Fights Cancer, as I mentioned, good friend, and is now an author. Author of a new book called Eddie Olczyk, Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. That book is out right now. He is in studio right now. Edzo, it is so good to see you. How are you, man?
What's up, Jim? Nice to be with you, pal.
Great to be with you. How are things? How are you feeling?
Everything's good. I'm watching you all the time back home in Chicago. I got you on the cable. I get to be right here in the jungle with you, so it's great to be
good,
with
man.
You.
Good, man. Thanks for having me. Thank you so much. Eddie, you've always been one of the great storytellers, which is why I love talking to you. So what was the process for you like to sit down and write this book? In other words, was it fun? Was it challenging? Was it emotional?
It was all of the above, and I think probably therapeutic, Jim, considering what has transpired in my life health-wise over the course of the last couple of years. And I've had the opportunity to write a book over the years just with my journey of whether, you know, people doubting me to ever get to the National Hockey League, of being a kid from Chicago, being American born back in the early 80s, making a U.S. Olympic hockey team when I was 16 years old back in 1984. But it was the point where I was like, nah, you know, who wants to read about me? And I was like, when I got sick, I think, no pun intended, but I think that was the final chapter in my mind to go ahead and write that book, because I thought, you know what? Maybe I can help or inspire or bring hope to one person that said, hey, I can relate to people that are in a battle with colon cancer. And I think that was my goal. And that's what the goal of the book is. I think I really believe, Jim, is that if I can inspire, keep somebody away from it, help them get through the day, let alone the battle of, regardless if it's colon cancer or any type of illness. But I think you'll laugh, and I think you'll love a little bit more when you read this book. And if I can make somebody smile or maybe have them look at something a little bit differently, then it was well worth the 16 months. And it was pen to paper. I'm not good on that, man.
I'm not on that
World Wide Web thing. I'm no good.
That's funny. Eddie Olczyk joining us on the program right now. The book is called Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. It's out right now. I want to talk about some of the things you went through, but let's talk some hockey, Ed.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, you're no stranger to adversity, and it goes way back. You were cut from a youth prospects camp. What do you remember about that?
I remember going out for a camp, and I was like 14 years old. And that particular time, I was the best 14-year-old hockey player in our country. There was only one better hockey player in North America at that time, and his name was Mario Lemieux.
Uh-huh.
And right. They had that right at that time. They still got it right, obviously, of all time. But I went to a camp, Jim, and it was one of those where you skate around for an hour, and then they go from like 300 kids to 100 kids and then to 20 kids. And I went out, and then they put the names up on the list, and I got cut. I'm like, wow. I mean, I was devastated. 14 years old, the first adversity I pretty much ever had in hockey. And my dad just pretty much looked at me and said, you know what? You got to work a little harder and be a little bit better. Let's go. So we left home, or we left the rink. We went home, and I'm like, wow, it was a great teaching point at that time. Adversity was. It was like, look, yeah, there were politics involved. I didn't know what politics were. And ended up, a couple of years later, making a U.S. Olympic hockey team at 16 years old.
All right, so then you have that, but you did bounce back, right? So
yeah.
You write about your first training camp with Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid from Chicago,
yeah.
What was it like to go to your first camp with your hometown team?
Yeah, it was a lot of pressure.
Right.
A lot of pressure. I mean, because it never had happened before. I was the first ever American-born native son to be drafted by his hometown team in the first round of the NHL draft, and I'm proud of that. I mean, American hockey has gone through the roof over the course of the last 25 years, but you know what? We need to tip our hockey helmets to the 1980 Miracle on Ice team, because they really opened up the door for us, Jim, at the Olympics in Lake Placid in 1980. But, you know, I think I learned at a very young age, and I think I learned it at home, where I went into that training camp with a lot of attention just because I was a Chicago kid and it never happened before. But I went there and I kept my eyes open, my ears open, and my mouth shut. That's the way that you earn the respect of the older guys in a locker room in professional sports. And look, I was 18. I mean, I was playing with some really old guys that were 25 and 30.
Hey, listen,
I wish I was 25 or 30 right
listen,
now.
Listen, I understand. And you've made the point that, like, guys in the NHL, hockey guys are, like, some of the best guys ever.
Right.
But this was not a case of somebody coming up with Toronto and becoming a Maple Leaf. This had never happened in this country.
Right.
And you're an 18-year-old kid. Even if you're keeping your mouth shut, you were trying to take food off somebody else's table.
Right.
What was it like to go in there and to be in that situation?
Well, I mean, you knew exactly why you were there, and you knew that, look, you may be getting a lot of attention. Look, I got a lot of attention. I didn't ask for it. It just happened to come with it. And when you're in that situation, you're like, look, I want to play here. I signed my contract. The opportunity's presented itself. I'm just going to try to fit in as best as I can, and I'm going to that's how I think I learned. And I think it's helped me both on and off the ice over the years, Jim, where I could look at how older guys carry themselves, like kind of what to say, where to go, how to act, how you treat the trainers.
Like who was in that room at that time?
I had Dennis Savard. I had Doug Wilson. I had Troy Murray. I mean, I had Al Secord. I mean, that's some of the greatest team guys. Steve Larmer, who I ended up playing with the Rangers in 94. We won a Stanley Cup. So I think for me, I learned from those older guys, and hopefully I was able to transfer what I learned from those guys to the guys that were younger when I was a veteran guy.
What an amazing room that must have been.
Yeah.
Eddie Olczyk joining me in studio. He's got a brand new book out. So your first game was against Detroit. What do you remember about pulling on that sweater and heading out onto the ice for the first time?
Well, for all those years, and we all have our favorite teams as young kids. And for me, it was the Blackhawks. And I used to go to all the games at the old Chicago Stadium. And I always dreamed about what it would be like, because I always knew what it was like to look from the stands at Chicago Stadium through the glass out into the ice. And then all of a sudden now it's reversal. I'm the one that's standing on the ice looking through the stands into the crowd. And, oh, by the way, I have my family there, my mom and dad and my brothers. Mm. And then, you know, the city of Chicago, because I was one of them. And I was one of their very own. So it was it's something I dreamed about my whole life. And to be able to put that sweater on for the very first time was like I lived a dream. I was living a dream to be able to put that on. And I remember sitting in the locker room at the old Chicago Stadium. We're getting ready to play the Red Wings. And I'm just like, this is it. Like, I've arrived. Like, this is it. Now you gotta go out there and do something about it.
But, Ed, there's so much more to it. I mean, the team wins. You score.
Yeah.
The crowd was chanting your name. Now, that's the stuff of dreams right there. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it was, you know, I mean, it's hard not to have a tear come down your eye in a situation like that, because you always wondered, like, how would the puck go in the back of the net? Like, would I be able to succeed? How would I be received? How would I react? All those things. And obviously an arch rival game between the Blackhawks and Red Wings. So it was, I mean, look, we hear the phrase a lot. I mean, a dream come true. But I mean, it was something that I thought about my whole life, to be able to play one game, let alone play 1,000 games in the NHL. But to be able to score a goal in my first game certainly capped it off.
Eddie Olczyk joining me in studio. He's got a brand new book out. It's called Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. This book is out right now. You can get it. It's a great read. Ed, you and I have talked in the past about so many things and some of the other challenges. And we've talked about the time that you were diagnosed. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about August 4th, 2017, 7:07 p.m., when you get the call telling you have stage 3 colon cancer. Is there anything in your life that could have possibly prepared you for that moment?
No, not at all, Jim. It was, you know, 5 days prior to that, I was a healthy guy. And the next thing you know, I wake up, I can't go to the bathroom for a couple of days. And next thing you know, I'm having a 6-hour surgery, removing 14 inches of my colon and removing a tumor the size of my fist. And they're telling me that they're going to send it out. And, you know, I mean, I was preparing for the worst. But when that phone rings, you get a call from a doctor or a hospital on a Friday night after 7 o'clock, it's probably not a call that, you know, is a good one. And that's exactly what happened at those digits that you gave. And my wife, Diana, of 31 years, was standing right next to me. And, you know, I just said, look, I can't answer the phone. It kept ringing and ringing, but I knew what it was, and said, look, you got to take it. And Dr. Scott Strong, who was my surgeon, told me, and he says, I'm recommending 6 months of chemotherapy. And it's like, you know, how long do I have to live? I didn't know. I mean, I heard the word cancer. I thought, well, how long do I have to live?
Is that immediately where your mind goes?
Absolutely.
How much
for
time
me
do
it
I have
did.
Left?
For me, it did. And I'm like, how am I going to walk down the stairs with my 4 kids sitting downstairs? And I know my wife prepared them for the worst, but for me to go down those stairs and look them in the eye and let them know that I was sick, was probably the hardest thing I had to do through that whole battle. And you, the last thing as a parent, you know this, the last thing you ever want to do is hurt your kids or worry your kids or maybe, you know, take their focus away. Like they always, they look at you in a certain way, but when you tell them that you're sick, they become worried and their focus goes a different direction. And that was the hardest thing, is that I scared them. And that's the last thing you want to do, is let down your kids and say, look, we're going to get through this. You know, we're going to battle and, you know, we have great help. And, you know, and so it just, that was the one thing that really kind of put everything in perspective when I was like, okay, now how is this going to affect my kids down the road? I mean, those are all the things that somebody that gets sick like this, you think about. I mean, you feel less, you feel weak, you feel like you let everybody down. It's like, well, since I've absorbed the disease, how is this going to affect my four kids? And like that's where you just go into this oblivion. You drift into this black hole. You're like, how did I do this? And are they going to be affected by this? Not only mentally, but maybe physically. I don't know. So they're obviously going to have to be checked out way earlier than maybe most people. But that was a difficult time. And we had some ups and downs, but we got through it together, and we're very, very lucky.
Eddie Olczyk is joining us. You know, I've shared this story, Ed. You and I have talked about this, but I remember when my father was diagnosed with leukemia, mm-hmm. and I remember I went to the hospital, and we did not know what was going on. And I remember he and my mother told me and my sister that he had leukemia. Right. And that it had gotten into his brain and ultimately needed brain surgery. So I know exactly the conversation you're talking about. It's right. The hardest conversation you could ever possibly have, to tell those close to you that you're going through something like this. You know, one of the things that I've always appreciated about our conversations, when you took this on and you faced this, there were some extremely dark times, troubling times, disturbing times, and people don't want to address that, and understandably so. It's so private. I've told the story also. When my father was diagnosed, they wouldn't let us tell anybody. They ran a business, and they said, we're not telling our parents. Right. We're not telling anybody. And I thought to myself, that's unbelievable. But that's how they wanted to handle it. You did talk about this. You talked about the troubling times, how they nearly broke you. Why was it important for you to share that?
Well, because I have the ability and the platform, Jim, and I thank you again, as I have over the years, the many times I've been with you on your show, to be able to communicate this message. And if I can help one person to recognize maybe a situation where they need to raise their hand and go, I need to see a doctor, or to help them get through the day and know that, look, my side effects brought me to my knees. My second treatment, Jim, I would just go to the bathroom. Like, I couldn't even run to the bathroom. I just would go to the bathroom. I had no control over that. Nosebleeds, blood clot, neuropathy, headaches. I'm like, this is treatment 2. How in the hell am I going to get to treatment 12 in February? And I was like, I quit. And I've never quitted anything in my life. Whether I've been down 7-1 in a hockey game, coaching the Pittsburgh Penguins, being down $25 at the racetrack. Okay, let me rephrase. $2,500 at the racetrack. I'm not quitting. And I told my wife, I'm done. I can't live like this. And my wife grabbed me and said probably the most important things during this whole journey. And she said, you need to fight. You need to fight for me. You need to fight for our kids. And you need to fight for all the people that love you. And that straightened me out, Jim. That brought me from that deep hole. That brought me out of that drifting into oblivion mindset where, okay, I'm in pain, I'm hurting, but I only can do what I can, and I'm going to fight. I'm just going to go day to day. I can't worry about 4 months from now, Jim. I can't worry about 6 months of chemo and then they're going to reassess. So I needed that. And it does test your will to live. And if somebody hears my story and I can help them get through the day and say, hey, you know what? If that old hockey player and that broken down horse player can do it, well, I can do it too. And if I can inspire one person, Jim, one person to stay away from it, to deal with it, to help them go through the day, then me being with you here today or somebody reading my book or hearing my story, then was well worth me. And look, I say this in all due respect. We all have a circle and we all have a story. I am glad I am the one that got the disease, because knowing what I know now, it would kill me to see somebody that I love go through this. And you lived it. And the caretakers and caregivers, we need to make sure we're looking out after them, because they're going through a hell of a lot too. Maybe not physically, but the mental part. I never saw my wife down. I never saw my wife worried or weak around me, Jim. But I know when she was not around me, her guard was down. And she probably let all her emotions out, but she had to be strong for me. We need to make sure we're looking after the caretakers as well.
Eddie Olczyk joining us. There's so much in that answer that I could respond to, but Diana, like Ed, you were kind of, you were brought up like this. You've been competing since the earliest of ages. Right. You were an athlete. Mm-hmm. You learned all these lessons. Where did she come to all of this? How was it that in that moment when you wanted to give up, mm-hmm. she said, oh, no, you're not. You need to fight. And to your point, anybody who's been through this, the person who is picking the other person up is going to hell and back but never wants to show that fear or concern right. because they can't. Like, right. how did she right. know how to react to this?
I really believe, Jim, and if I get emotional, I'm sorry, but I believe is that when I was going through this battle, I've always let the most important people in my life know what they have meant to me. I've always told them, look, God forbid if something would happen. If I was not around and you didn't know what you meant to me and how much you've meant to me in my life, it would kill me. It would kill me to know that I didn't tell you enough. And it always would be, oh, nothing's going to happen, nothing's going to happen. But I think for me going through this, even when I was at my darkest, I was at peace, Jim. I was at peace because everybody most important in my life knew how I felt about them. And that helped me get through. And I think that moment is my wife leaned on that and saw me at my lowest, saw me at my weakest, and felt that I needed to be straightened out. Because like I said, I had enough quiet time to last me a lifetime. I'd lay in my basement for 17 hours and you veg. You just like, you take the medicine. I would take it every 2 weeks, like most people, every 2 weeks for 48 hours. They'd come and unhook me, and then you have three awful days, and then you'd have a good 5 or 6 days, and they say, okay, well, you got to come back in now. So I think in that particular moment, me being at peace, even though I was weak and I wanted to bail, my wife had that ability to be able to just talk to me directly. Maybe when we were talking initially, I wasn't hearing what she was saying. Maybe I was listening, but I really wasn't comprehending what she was saying. And I just needed to get back on a straight and narrow. Look, I would not be here today if I had to do this by myself. And there are so many people, and I feel for them, that have to go through this themselves. They don't have the ability to communicate with anybody. I had that incredible support. And that was, to me, was probably one of the most powerful things that happened. That was a turning point, Jim. We know what happened in Game 6 last night in the World Series. There are turning points. And for me, at the most crucial point in my life, when it comes to the health part, that was a turning point for me that my wife bailed me out and got me back out. And that's when I got back my hockey helmet on and said, okay, I'm going to chip away. I'm going to set goals for myself. And we're going to take this day to day.
All right, so let's do this, Ed. Let's take a time out. When we come back, I want to get your thoughts and the message you have for somebody who might be dealing with this. People want your thoughts on the Breeders' Cup. I want to hit that
too. Let's go.
Spend some time with a very good friend of the program and cover everything in one segment with Eddie Olczyk. So we got a bonus segment. He's still here in studio. Again, Ed's got a brand new book out. It's called Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. It is out now. I would encourage you very strongly to get it. And before I talk about the Breeders' Cup, which I know you're going to have some thoughts on, one last thought. If somebody is dealing with a recent diagnosis and they don't have that kind of support around them, or they don't know what to do with it or what to think, and they're terrified, understandably so, what is your message to them?
Well, I think my message to them is to know that there are people out there that can be an ear for them, can be somebody that they can lean on, whether they know them or not. And I think the one thing for me, Jim, is that I have the ability in this platform that, you know, I get contacted, sadly, I think way too much, that people want to get advice, want to share their story, want to be prepared for maybe what's ahead of them that they've been recently diagnosed. But I think for anybody out there that is in that battle is to know that there is that support and to fight. I mean, that to me is probably the one thing, because you're so worried about, obviously, the end result, but it's that aspect of being in the battle and knowing that it's going to be hard and you're going to be scared. Look, I'm still scared now. I mean, I'm cancer-free right now, but every time I go back for a three-month checkup, the anxiety goes through the roof. Always. My blood pressure's up and my heart rate, and the nurse is saying, boy, your heart rate's up today. Well, yeah. Well, what the hell do you think? I'm fine at home. I'm 59 resting heart rate, and I come in here and I'm 108. Oh, yeah, I'm a little nervous.
Sure.
I'm a little scared. So brings back those things. But, you know, I just want people to know that, you know, there's hope and regardless of what the diagnosis may be. And I asked a lot of questions too, Jim. Like I did. Like when I got the diagnosis and I was the chemotherapy, and I'm like, okay, so, you know, like you're 6 months of chemotherapy, right? And he says, look, I am here to cure you, not treat you. Do you understand the difference? And that was Dr. Mary Mulcahy, who was my oncologist. And, you know, we're with you. I mean, you have to know that. And you need to be able to grab something onto and hold on to that and fight for that and to be able to just kind of go day to day. Because look, in the big picture, aren't we all? Like, really? When it's all said and
absolutely
done, we're all day to day, right?
Yeah. All right, so now we are a couple of days away from the Breeders' Cup.
Yes, sir.
In Santa Anita. Who are some, and this is a major, major event, but who are some of the horses that are catching your eye right now?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, it's, what, 14 races we have, Jim. And, I mean, when you're a handicapper like I am and a horse player, like, you don't have to invest a whole heck of a lot to really hit the jackpot. You really don't. But, I mean, obviously, the Breeders' Cup Classic. To me, the Dirt Mile is another great race, both on Saturday. I'm looking forward to being a part of our NBC coverage on television. And, you know, when I look at the Breeders' Cup Classic, Bob Baffert and McKenzie, you know, probably will be the favorite, but you know what? This is the first time in a long time we haven't had a stone cold favorite. Like, I think McKenzie's going to be in that 3-1, 7-2 range. Like, I think you're going to be all over the map. But the one horse I am going to zero on is Vino Rosso. For Todd Pletcher, for Vinny Viola, the owner of the Florida Panthers, he co-owns that horse with Mike Rapoli. He's proven on the Santa Anita track. He loves the mile and a quarter. He comes off an incredible work in his last work getting ready for the Breeders' Cup Classic. I think he's very tactical. So that's one horse there. I look at Vino Rosso. I think you can get every bit of 4-1 or 5-1. I really do. You got the mayor in there late. I think it's a wide open race. You can make a case. If you sit there and say, yeah, I make a case for 5, I'd go, yeah, you're probably maybe even short. And you don't know how the track's going to be playing as well. So Vino Rosso is the one horse that I'm going to be using all of my tickets on in a classic. And if you can get 4 or 5-1, Jim, I'm going to be in with both hands. I think this horse is going to run a monster race on Saturday.
Some of the most surreal days ahead of my entire life have been at the Breeders' Cup. Like, when people who do not know the game or don't follow the sport closely, they look for the Kentucky Derby. They know that. But what about the Breeders' Cup Classic? It's different. How is it different than, like, the Kentucky Derby? What does that weekend represent to that sport?
Well, because it's the proven horses at these particular conditions, and you get the best horses from all over the world, right? You say the Kentucky Derby to anybody out there, whether they're a horse racing fan or not, they know exactly Louisville Churchill Downs first Saturday in May and the Run for the Roses. They know that. But when you talk about the Breeders' Cup, like, this is everything. Super Bowl, World Series, Stanley Cup, whatever it is, you get the best horses, the best jockeys, the best betting fields that we have all year. Like, I've scoured over the Friday and Saturday, and you can sit there and go 4 and 5 deep in every race and go, yeah, I like that horse. I like that horse. So for me, this is a kid in the candy store weekend. And oh yeah, by the way, I get to work and I get to play at the same time. So it's a hell of a weekend. I do have to say, though, that Saturday I'm going to have the ultimate daily double.
What do you got?
Saturday, I do 7 hours of coverage on NBC, SN, and NBC doing the Breeders' Cup. And then I get to get in a car right after the Breeders' Cup Classic and travel down to Staples, or over to Staples, and do the Blackhawks-Kings game on Saturday night.
Good day, Ed.
Let me just tell you, I hope I am packing heavy on Saturday night. Most importantly, as long as I got a little bit more here in my right pocket, it's been one hell of a day. I'm going to put my head to that pillow on Saturday night, Jim, and I'm going to sleep very well on Saturday night.
Eddie Olczyk joining us. Let me ask you this, and nobody, you don't ever want to talk betting, not check that. You don't want to talk money, but I've also shared this story, Ed. When Ms. Direction won the Breeders' Cup, and remember, she came off on the morning line 20-1.
Yeah.
20-1.
Yeah.
The sharps knew better. The wise guys knew better. They bet her down to 6-1.
Right.
Being one of the owners of the horse, what did I care? I bet her a grand across. Went down to 6-1. Dude, I walked out there with 25 grand in my pocket.
That's it.
It felt good, man.
Too bad.
That was the best day of my life.
Too bad you didn't get the, you locked those odds, in at 20-1, right?
Can you do the math for me? How much would I have made?
Well, if you bet 1,000 at 21, that's 20,000 on the win bet. You probably would end up probably getting 46 grand for 1,000 across. Yeah, 20-1. Yeah.
I felt me. And then I was wondering why I didn't go three across. It was great. Listen, you really quickly.
Sometimes you got to step up and put your plums on the table, right? Exactly.
Why didn't I do that?
Yeah.
Because she hadn't raced in 6 months. Yeah. She had never been in a grade one. She had never run against the boys.
But special filly.
Ed, you would have told me, though. You would have said, course for horse, course for horse. You love that downhill course. All right, really quickly, in terms of the start of the NHL season, most teams have played somewhere around a dozen plus games. Yeah. It's early. What kind of things have stuck out to you so far?
Boy, Washington, to me, really sticks out. I think they're going great guns. I was a little concerned about their defense with all the changes that they had. They lost Matt Niskanen, veteran guy. They lost Brooks Orpik. But they have been playing extremely well. I mean, without a doubt, in the Eastern Conference. Ovi's, he had a four-point game, I think, last night against the Leafs. And out west, a team that I don't know if a lot of people have talked about, but we'll be talking about a lot, whether it's this year or not, Jim, are the Avs, the Colorado Avalanche. They lost Landeskog. They lost Rantanen and two of their top three players and Nathan MacKinnon up front. But the Avalanche are real. Like, they are in, like, they are in it for a long time.
I love them.
They are fast. They are an up-tempo team. If they can get the goaltending from Grubauer, they will be a dangerous team. Obviously, health has a lot to do with it, but they got some guys coming as well. Like, if you're talking about buying a stock moving forward, that's a buy, buy, buy. That's a strong buy moving forward. Now, are they good enough to win a cup this year? I'm not sure, but I would guarantee pretty much health being first and foremost. And within the next couple of years, the Avalanche will be playing for a Stanley Cup.
What an amazing conversation. We covered so much ground. I want to remind you, Eddie Olczyk has got a brand new book out. It's called Beating the Odds in Hockey and in Life. You need to get this book. He is a lead NHL analyst and a horse racing analyst for NBC Sports. He won a Stanley Cup. We didn't even get into that with the Rangers. He is a member of the 84 Olympic and U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame out here for the Breeders' Cup. Edzo, it is so good to see you. You are in great health. You sound great. You look great. Congrats on the book. You know I love you, and I appreciate that you came in to talk about the book as well.
Love you too, Jim. All the best to the family, man. Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it.
Always.
Good night now.